You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You have to put in headphones. As part of her job as a hospice chaplain in South Carolina, Carrie Eakin often finds herself listening to dying patients' stories, stories about loss, shame, and guilt, about times of great joy, and sometimes even about long-held family secrets. Ms. Eakin relates some of those stories and includes a few of her own in her new book called On Living. It is published by Riverhead, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Haven't you found in your work as a chaplain that most of your patients are more interested in talking to you about their lives and their families than in praying or talking about God?
Yeah, I would say that's true. It surprised me at first when I was a young chaplain, when I was first starting out. And I think I thought I was maybe not doing it well. But what I've come to realize is that people at the end of their lives want to talk to the chaplain about the things they've experienced and the stories in their lives, because that's how they make meaning. And that's the task of the spiritual life at the end of life, is to make meaning and sense of the things you've experienced.
A kind of a summation?
Yeah. I don't know if I would say a summation.
But we all look, that joke, what's the meaning of life? Of course, there's no answer to that.
It's different. It's different for every single person. I think some people might say, there's no meaning, we're just here, and then we're gone. And that is a perfectly valid spiritual life and answer. But I think a lot of people find a lot of meaning in their lives.
So does the storytelling often give them a way of finding peace before they die?
It does. I think that the storytelling, I've been thinking a lot about this, like why? Because people are, what does the telling of stories do? And I think in the process of telling those stories and making meaning of their stories, that is how you build strength, right? That's how you build emotional strength. And not just at the end of your life. People can do this throughout their lives, right? People do this throughout their lives. They have these things that happen that don't make sense, that don't align with how they thought life would be. And they have to stop and take a step back and make sense of it, find a new meaning, or else you don't cope well.
And as a result, you have come to think of yourself as a story keeper.
Yes. I do.
I'd imagine that most of what you've been told you need to keep you've been told to keep this confidential, but don't some of your patients, including one named Gloria, want you to pass on their stories in the hopes that others can learn from their mistakes?
Mm-hmm. And she was very specific about that. So Gloria is one of the patients whose stories I tell in this book.
Two stories, in fact.
Yeah, two stories. And related. And, for a long time, I didn't quite realize how related they were. But she was the one who said to me, as we were talking, she said, I lived such a crazy life, and I have these amazing stories, and I feel like they're just going to die with me, and no one else is ever going to learn from them. I had to go through all of this, and now it's going to die with me. And she said, I used to wish I could meet a writer, and she goes, and now I just sit in this recliner, I can't get up. And she said, and I used to pray and pray and pray to meet a writer. And I had written a book 12 years earlier, but I wasn't there as a writer, you have to be careful as a chaplain. You don't insert yourself into people's stories, into people's lives. You're there for them, not for yourself. I thought, well, I need to tell her. I feel like it kept going on and on. And I said, I was a writer. And she said with so much joy, will you pass along my stories?
And these stories are really interesting. And if you'd written them as a short story writer, they would still be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One of them involved
really
a secret that her grandmother had kept until she died.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other was a secret that Gloria herself had kept for years.
Almost until she died. So the first story she started with, so this was in South Carolina, and Gloria was an elderly woman. And she told this story about how when she was a child, she and her brothers and sisters would go out with her parents and her grandmother to a farm every single Sunday. And they would spend the entire day after church working to the bone. I mean, working their fingers to the bone really hard on this farm. And the farm was owned by an African-American woman and her children. And she had no idea who these people were. But going out there, every single Sunday her entire childhood. She grew very close to this woman and to these children. I mean, they really were some of her best friends. And then she sort of grew up and she left her parents' house. And
but we're talking about racially segregated South, Jim Crow
yes.
South.
Yes. Oh, it? Yeah. Jim Crow South. I mean, this is the South, you know, back in the 1930s, 40s. And when she would ask who they were, she was never told. In fact, you know, once she was smacked across the face, you know, never ask that question again. This is just what we do. And so she just sort of accepted that. And then when she grew up, she was at her grandmother's funeral. And this black woman came up to her and said, "Gloria, do you recognize me?" And she said, "No." And the woman said, I'm you know, what, Betty, the little girl you used to play with." And she said, and then I did recognize her. And then she said, "And I'm your cousin." And Gloria said, "What?" And it turns out her, you know, her father's sibling, her father's father, her father's brother had married or did not marry, was not allowed to marry, but had made a life with a woman he loved who happened to be black, and they had children, and then he died. And she had no one to help her on the farm, and so his family stepped in, but they could never admit it. They could never admit they loved them, and yet they couldn't admit who they were to each other. And people walk around with stories like that all the time.
And then Gloria told you a story that she'd kept secret from everyone until mm-hmm. she finally told it to you.
Yeah.
Why you?
Why me? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, let me tell you what the story was. She had a son. She had a son before she was married. And she was going to give this child away. And she had gone to a home for unwed mothers. And she did give the child away. And when she came home, she said, "I realized with every ounce of my body that I had made a terrible mistake." Now, she was a young girl at the time. She was 20 years old, still lived in her parents' home, unmarried, you know, at a time when women didn't have the opportunities they have now. And she felt she had to give this child away because otherwise, she said, "I would have been garbage. You know, women like me, I didn't want to be garbage." And so for her to wake up the day after she came home, after giving her child up for adoption, and to realize, "I had made a mistake." And she said, "And I had to get my baby back." And we have to put ourselves in the mindset of what a 19, 20-year-old girl in 1950 in rural South Carolina, what that would have been like to have that strength, that kind of courage to say, "This is what I need to do." And she did. But then she kept it a secret, right? She loved her. She said, "I loved him so much. I loved my child so much that I gave up everything for him." And then she never told him. And she wanted him to know before she died how much she loved him and what she had done for him.
But didn't she get married?
She did.
So her husband must have known because
came
with
a child. Right, and this was
the big secret. But he also helped to keep the secret. He just acted as though he was the father of the son.
But very much resented the child. And that's what she wanted her son to know. She said, "I think he always knew his father didn't love him right. And I think he might have always thought it was his fault. And I want him to know it wasn't because of something with him, that there's this family secret." But she was so, the shame she still carried after all those decades was still so strong that she wasn't sure it was stronger than the love she felt for her child.
You say that people keep their secrets out of shame or guilt, but that they are two distinct emotions. How are they different?
They're two distinct emotions, and they're also two distinct processes.
But can somebody suffer from both at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Usually people have both. So when anthropologists talk about, you know, shame versus guilt, they say that guilt is – they're both forms of social control, right? They're both ways that society uses to get people to – stay in line, to, you know, not commit crimes, to not be, you know, corrupt. And that guilt is the idea that you have a sort of an internal moral compass, and that when you instill guilt in someone, they know right and wrong. And if they break right and wrong, if they do something they know to be wrong, they feel enormous guilt. Even if nobody else ever knows about it, they feel enormous guilt. So like if you're ever walking down the street, you know, and you've got a paper cup and there's no one around, you could throw that paper cup on the sidewalk and keep going. But we don't. Why don't we? Because we would feel terribly guilty.
Some people do, unfortunately.
Some people do, right? Shame is different. So shame is not because is because you feel guilty sort of within yourself. Shame is a different form of social control, and shame comes from the outside. So shame would be, I've got this coffee cup and I'm walking down the street, there's no garbage can, and here comes a lady walking towards me. She is really gonna look down on me if I just throw this on the ground. That's a very mild example of shame. So shame comes from the outside.
Now, you've worked as a chaplain, but you're not ordained?
No. Mm-mm.
You went to Harvard Divinity School? Mm-hmm. So what's the difference?
So ordination, people who are pastors or priests of a church, well, I shouldn't say, I don't know if you call it ordination for rabbis and imams, but that sort of formal certification by a religious body, you know, that I'll call ordination, is what people who are working within a particular religious tradition get. And those are people's whose primary role is really to preach and teach to their congregants. A chaplain's role is completely different. A chaplain's role is not to preach or teach, because by the time, especially a hospice chaplain, by the time we get there, there's no time for that. Our role as a hospice chaplain is to look at what people already believe, whatever spiritual beliefs and strengths they already have, and to help them use those things to make meaning or find meaning in this dying process. It's a very different role.
Did you know before you started school that you wanted to work as a hospital or a hospice chaplain?
No, not at all. No.
Did the job turn out to be?
I didn't even really know they existed.
You didn't know what you learned about it in school?
In school. So I learned about it. My dad died my first year of divinity school. And he had been very sick his whole life. He had juvenile diabetes. And he had been in and out of hospitals really my entire childhood. And then he died my first year of div school. And I had gone to divinity school thinking I wanted to get a PhD in religion. And I wanted to study what people call sort of lived religion. You know, people's, not theology, not the ideas, but people's everyday experience of religion. I just found that fascinating. And that's what I wanted to study. And then my first year of my master's program in divinity school, my dad died. And it just threw me for a loop. I really struggled. I was grieving. It was my first real major loss. I was 20, 24, I guess. And when I came back to school the next fall, I decided I would do an internship. I'm still not sure what really fully led me to... But I decided I would do an internship at a hospital and try out being a chaplain. And in that experience of being a chaplain, a student chaplain, I realized that you could study lived religious experience, but chaplains, you're actually seeing it, right? That's what you're doing as a chaplain. You are actually sitting there and listening to people. It's mostly listening. You're listening to people as they live their religious experience, as they struggle with these questions of, why is this happening? What does this mean? Is there a God? Is my religious faith true? Is it helpful? So you actually get to see lived religious experience. And that was much more exciting to me than studying for a PhD.
Many chaplains are ordained ministers, mm-hmm. nuns, other clergy mm-hmm. members. Is there an advantage to being an unordained chaplain?
I don't think it's an advantage or a disadvantage. I think I just never felt called to ordination.
In general, do you find that most of your patients are afraid to die, or have they started to come to terms with death since they're in a hospice and know that they are in the process of dying?
I think that every patient is very different, because just as every person living is very different, you're still living when you're dying. You're just as different. It's hard to make a blanket statement. But I will say that people in hospice have, on some level at least, acknowledged there is no cure for what I am dying of, and I'm going to die of this disease. Now, they might not emotionally have fully accepted that, but on some level they have. And so there's a level of acceptance with hospice patients that might not be there with patients in the hospital.
Although there can be other factors. One of your patients, a born-again Christian, told you she was afraid to die because some of her children had not been born again, so
right.
She could not be admitted into heaven.
Well, they could not be admitted into heaven.
So how do you comfort someone in that situation?
So... for people who aren't sort of familiar with that belief, it's an idea in certain forms of evangelical Christianity that in order to go to heaven after death, you have to be saved. And you're saved by accepting Jesus Christ as your personal savior. And it's sort of a very specific notion of what in theology we call soteriology, which is sort of these theories of salvation. And this woman and many women in her situation, if you have a child who has not been born again, you truly believe that they're not going to heaven. You're never going to see them again. And not only that, they could very well be going to hell, depending on your particular religious beliefs. That is a spiritual crisis, right? That's what chaplains do. When we talk about like someone's in a spiritual crisis, that's a crisis. You love these children, you love God, and you cannot make these two things match up. That's where we talk about meaning making. When we say a chaplain facilitates meaning making, when the things you believe don't match up with what you're experiencing, that's what we do. That's a spiritual crisis.
What can you do when the person you're dealing with is in late stage dementia and no longer able to communicate, may not even appear to be conscious?
So dementia patients are very challenging. Dementia, all the related dementias, are sort of in some ways these secret diseases in our culture. We don't see them very much. When I worked as a hospital chaplain, I never saw them. I had no experience in them. I really didn't learn about what dementia does, Alzheimer's, Lewy body disease, all these different dementias until I worked in hospice. And I feel like it's most people have no idea what these diseases do. And a nurse explained it to me once that in dementia, you sort of step backwards through human development. You know, that a baby learns to hold up their head, they learn to smile, they learn to make eye contact, they learn to talk. That in dementia, you literally step backwards through human development. And so the last stage of dementia before you die is you lose the ability to hold up your head. And so I think a lot about offering spiritual care for people with dementia in the same way I would think about offering spiritual care for very young children, for you know, infants, toddlers, preschoolers. Because developmentally, that helps me think about it. That helps. And so for me, with those patients, it's very much as it would be with a baby. It's about physical care and comfort. It's knowing you are loved. It is knowing that someone is present with you. It's very difficult emotionally because you question yourself over and over again, what am I doing? Am I helping at all? And you don't know that you are. And then it's also very simple. It's the most simple thing we do as chaplains, which is that we offer, you know, a spiritual presence, pastoral presence, peaceful presence. People have different words for it, but you are present in the moment with where that person is, wherever they are. You meet them where they are. That's what you do as a chaplain.
Is it difficult for you to stay calm or stay present when people around you are falling apart?
Sometimes, sure. Yeah, sometimes. But you know what? That's kind of your job. That's your, you know.
And you admit in this book that you're not always perfect
in
dealing with these things.
I would be suspicious of anybody who claims that they are. It's a hard job, you know. And I'm human too. And I know sometimes, you know, when you are, when you take on the role of chaplain, people have a very specific notion about what that means. And the work that they're able to do is because you're fulfilling a role. You bring yourself fully to that role, but you're also fulfilling a role. So sure, there are times where I'm panicking inside. There are times where I want to cry. There are times where I get really angry at the story I'm hearing. And that's when you have to have good boundaries. And people always think when you say boundaries that it's these big walls to keep people away. But it's not. Having really good boundaries means that you know how to keep yourself in, that you're not sort of bleeding out all over into other people's stories. But that's hard. It's hard. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of, I pray a lot. You know, I try to meditate. I try to walk in nature a lot. I take lots of dance classes. You have to be able to center yourself before you can be that peaceful presence for someone else. But it's not always easy.
Carrie Egan's book is On Living. It's published by Riverhead. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.